Welcome to Talking Agility, a podcast from Accenture. Your host is Elitsa Nacheva.
Hello and welcome back to Talking Agility. My guests today are keen to speak about behavioral science and how it influences enterprise agility. And I'm even keener to hear what they have to say. Diana Buria is the Managing Director within Accenture's Talent and Organization Practice, focusing on leadership and culture globally. Hello, Diana, and welcome to Talking Agility.
Hi, Ali. Good to be here.
And of course, I'm pleased to welcome back Andy Young to the podcast. Andy is the Managing Director within Accenture's Talent and Organization Practice. Hi, Andy. Welcome back to Talking Agility.
Hey, Ali. Hey, Diana.
Hi.
So both Andy and Diana joined me remotely from London today, and I can't wait to get into our conversation. So kicking off with my first question, let's talk about behavioral science, one incredibly fascinating topic to me and hopefully to our listeners. Can you give us a brief introduction to the topic?
Sure, I'll take a turn here. So behavioral science has been changing the way that we do change with our clients. It's all inspired by the brain. It's from the understanding that we've gained, and academics have been enlightening us on how the brain actually works from a number of different disciplines, whether it's neuroscience or behavioral economics. There's a whole range of topics that have come together, including psychology, and really helped us understand what makes the difference to how our clients can go on transformation journeys. The key points that we found with behavioral science have been made very popular from a number of sources and different books and TED Talks that everyone's been listening to. And there are things like social proof. There are things like nudge. There are a lot of different areas we're going to get into today. But the key point is we're helping our clients adopt a growth mindset to how they do transformation. So they try things. They try small things. They empower their people to shape and design what the transformation we're made up of. And they take their people together as a crowd along this journey by seeing what others are doing and responding to that.
Brilliant. And Andy, is there anything from your end that you would like to add?
I think I'll probably just reinforce one thing that Diana said, which is about this being something now where we co-create with groups of citizens or customers or colleagues, and something that I like to use the phrase, you know, make it cool, not creepy. You know, there's kind of good science well applied in a way that's co-creative with people, and then there's the bad application is where it's trying to manipulate people's behaviour in a way that's operating with less integrity. And the way we're trying to approach this is definitely in that value orientated way that Diana outlined, very much in that multidisciplinary way, but really the heart of it is doing it in a really strong ethical way and co-creating with people rather than doing to them.
Brilliant. So now that we have the definition of behavioral science out of the way, would you describe how it relates to enterprise agility?
So previously in past episodes, we talked about being agile, doing agile, and about this being a, you know, culture first thing. And culture is as Dino has told me many times, is the net of behaviours in the organisation. So it's the cumulative effect of behaviour and decisions that go on. And while each organisation's version of agility for their business is slightly different, there are some examples of behaviours that show up time and time again in organisations that are able to sense and respond to the opportunities and threats that they face externally and are able to generate continuous and transformational change inside their organisations. So some of those things, which we've touched on in other episodes, but just to bring them back into focus. The first one's really about customer focus, so putting the kind of customer at the heart of design and change and operations and thinking about, in an empathetic way, about their needs. So that the observable behaviour in that might be that customers join a design session virtually or physically in the room, or if we can't get customers in the room, we use a persona to anchor a design session, for example. Mm-hmm. There's a big piece about simplifying work. So prioritization, doing fewer things simpler and well, and then moving on to the next things rather than trying to do everything you could do. So being very clear about the link to business value, keeping work simple, and focusing on speed to value. And so the practical view of that in a team might be, do we all know what our shared goal is? Does the left hand know what the right hand's doing? Mm. And key to that is a cluster of behaviours around accountability, empowerment, and particularly aligned autonomy. This idea that we can collaborate and move together, and we can push decisions towards where the work happens, but that we can show individual accountability within that teamwork to get the job done. And I think one of the areas that's really coming into focus at the moment in the current environment where we're all remote working as we record this podcast is collaboration, teamwork, transparency and sharing of information. And, you know, obviously that's difficult when you're co-located. It's become even more of a muscle that we build when we're working remotely. And then lastly, one of the ones that's maybe slightly more intangible that people sometimes really struggle to build up in teams, but is that spark of creativity and innovation. There's that behaviour around, are we prepared to bring new ideas, open up new ideas, scale new ideas into the organisation? But really at the heart of this as Diana said, this is about the ability to move those mindsets and behaviours. One, we've got a whole load more wherewithal to do that, but we also understand it's much more important than ever before. Because if the fixed infrastructure of the organisation gets challenged under periods of constant change, actually our ability to move the mindsets and behaviours in a way that supports the vision and strategy for the organisation is so important. And you need to just look at kind of companies that have re-renewed themselves recently. I think Microsoft's a great example of that, about moving towards, you know, empowering an ecosystem, empowering their customers rather than trying to own it all. That learn it all versus know it all behavior that they've got. Now they're going to be really emphasizing growth mindsets, their emphasis on kind of client enablement over short term sales. Those are all great examples of highly value aligned behaviors in a business, and those behaviors and mindsets being used to move a business faster than some of the traditional ways you might have approached an organizational transformation. So I deeply believe the ability to move mindsets and behaviours is central to enterprise agility.
I think it's also worth adding to this sort of cocktail that we're talking about here, that often people will focus on tools, technologies that will enable people to be more agile, to think in a more fluid way, for example. But so much of it is the beliefs of what that person believes they can do within that work environment. You know, is that something that's permitted here? Is it something that's rewarded and recognized? Is it something that, you know, they individually feel is who they are? So it gets to identity as well. So taking a look with a behavioral science lens at what works and what doesn't work by doing experiments and, you know, what the behavioral scientists would call randomized controlled trials, to see if we try this, if we, you know, add this in, this element in, will that actually unleash agility? And adding things or taking things away at these different sort of logical levels, the identity level, the capability level, the environment, the beliefs, the mindsets, it lets you try and see where the difference is made. Because we're really searching in behavioral science for the difference that makes the difference. You know, what is it you need to put in or take away? What do leaders need to be doing? How do the processes and systems need to alter? And you try tiny changes to see what adds up to something worth having.
And that also just points me to the thought about having trust at the center of everything, something that will actually fuel behavioral science being successful when it relates to enterprise agility, because without the trust in psychological safety, then there wouldn't be that collaboration and that teamwork that Andy spoke about, nor the spark of creativity and innovation if people don't feel empowered by the leadership to be able to kind of create and think freely and adopt that growth mindset. So just wanted to make that point as well. And also kind of, I noticed there is a trend between what you mentioned in question one and in this question as well. You said in question one, it's kind of the, it's how the brain works. And then Andy, you said it's how sort of the left hand coordinating with the right hand. So I almost see kind of behavioral science, it's at the core of who we are as a, as human beings. We already have the brain and the hands involved. And probably, as you said, it's around kind of moving the mindsets, behaviors, and really the hearts. So we have three components from the human body as influenced by behavioral science.
You know, really strong long-term changes in behavior come from a place of belief. Doesn't necessarily mean that you can't fake it till you make it. So there's always things you can start to practice first. I've at home, I've recently been getting back on the exercise bike, and there's been a lot of faking it till I make it on that. So ultimately, there has to be some heart in any big change. There has to be an emotional reason why. Without that, I think we often approach these behavioural mindset challenges in traditional corporate environments in too much of a rational way.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're saying heart. You know, there's always a risk that people head into the left brain, right brain, which has been discredited in neuroscience world. But what is shown and researched well is that there are different parts of the brain, and some of these parts are evolutionary terms, a whole lot older than others. And these are where you sort of see the animal instincts playing, coming into play. So when we're talking in behavioral science terms about the crowd and the herd moving, it's because we are, a herd animal. We are part of the animal kingdom that acts when we see what others are doing. And the words that are used around that, and we can get into this now if you like, is social proof. Humans do what they see other humans do because it takes less mental energy, less cognitive power to follow the crowd, as we all learnt, in school days, than it does to stand alone and be the one going in a different direction. And that's what we need to harness in transformation and in helping our clients dial up this agility muscle. Because when it becomes the norm, when everyone is acting in these new ways that we've been outlining, more collaborative, more willing to share knowledge, more creative, more innovative, it becomes harder to do the old. And the old gets left behind because that's not what we now do. That's not the way we do things around here. And that's the power of behavioral science as well.
Great. And I think that's actually a great segue to my next question, which was around how we can apply behavioral science to the business. And Diana, you touched on the point of kind of the energy of new behaviors and the social proof. Would you mind just expanding a little bit more about the other elements that we can relate back to the business and the corporate environment?
Absolutely. So Ellie, we've been talking around this sort of multidisciplinary approach to how we lead on transformation. And one of our big influences is a guy called Dan Ariely, who does some amazing work in behavioral science.
I love
science.
Dan Ariely.
his framework that he was talking about most recently at a behavioral insight conference was around adding fuel and removing friction. And this is what we have picked up with delight and are seeing all kinds of applications. So in terms of the fuel, it is about creating energy for new behaviours. And we've spoken a bit already in this social proof. It's fuel that this is how we should act. We also talk about what will inspire, what's the link to purpose. These are all, again, putting more fuel on the fire to give people permission to make them stay with a new way of behaving and making a habit stick and become the way you act permanently. Leaders also fundamental to adding fuel, as are a lot of the HR processes. If you reinforce by giving people money, permission, status, by encouraging some new way of acting, it retains. Now, the other side of the coin is the friction. You need to take away the barriers to the new ways, to the adoption of platform or whatever new collaborative way of working where it might take place. You've got to block out the old. There's actually some examples from way back in sort of case studies at business school, which talk about burning the furniture. You actually have to get rid of the old way of being in that workspace so that people know they have to act differently. And for sure, Google and most of the new industry players have a different style of office workspace. And certainly now, you know, people often, certainly today, working remotely, being in a home environment creates different norms as well. So take out the barriers, send signals that this is how we're going to keep acting and keep fueling that. And also deal with the naysayers. When leaders are finding that transformation or change isn't progressing, often it's because that middle layer of management, the permafrost layer potentially, is saying, oh, it won't last, don't go with it, you know, just sit this one out and wait for the next change boss to come along. And actually that's friction. That is friction from the ground up and makes people believe that this isn't going to last, when in fact that's not the message they'd be hearing from the top if they got that access. So add the fuel, take out the friction, and coming back to where we started with these small changes, run experiments. And some of our colleagues at What If have been doing brilliant work in this space, getting people to try things and try them in the day job. So it isn't learning where you're out of your work environment. You learn experimental capability, but you then get back into the workplace and surround yourself with, say, each one of these change agents surrounded by 10 in their business, and they run an experiment themselves. And it's safe. It's a safe playground. It is the day job. It is the task that you're expected to perform in. And you're having that ownership and accountability and therefore feeling empowered to make it different and better. So it's a really compelling way to get people engaged and involved and stay with whatever works because they have their fingerprints all over it.
Yeah, and thank you for mentioning the experiments part and the work that our colleagues at What If are doing. We're hopefully going to have an episode with them. And I think there is a great case study with a client of ours that we'll probably ask them to highlight. But Andy, from your perspective, what else would you add around the application of behavioral science to the business?
So I'm going to try and bring it to life with a bit of an analogy. So, and dinosaur.
Love an analogy, please.
Dinosaur used this one before, so apologies to Diana in advance, but I find clients find it really useful. So, you know, how we turn up and behave inside the organisation is a bit like taking your favourite walk in the countryside or near the coast. And I want you to imagine a time of where we're not isolating and social distancing. So we actually can go for a walk together in the countryside. So I want you to imagine right now that walk. Your current habits are the well-trodden path you take through that walk. But you've heard from a friend who kind of tends to hand these like really cool tips about where to go. You've heard about this beach that's nearby to the trail that's absolutely amazing. Like, it's the nicest beach ever. And they've said, you've got to go, right? So there's something attractive and it's a nice sunny day. You kind of, there's an emotional hook there for you to kind of go and do something new and different, right? So you set off to find this beach. And you come off your familiar path, and that's, you know, in Diana's outline, you're experimenting, you're trying something new. You made a conscious choice to go somewhere. Now, the first time finding that beach is really difficult because you don't really know where you're going. The grass is a bit scratchy, and you're not actually really sure it's going to be worth it when you get there. But you kind of, you get there, and the beach is beautiful, and it's really fun. And so next time you're out on the walk, you decide to go back. And each time you walk that new path, it becomes easier and easier. And especially if you're going there with friends, suddenly that, you know, that path down to the beach becomes the path you always walk. So that old path you used to take, the old trail, you kind of walk that a little bit less often. And, you know, you're walking to the beach each time you go now without thinking about it. And that's how we unlearn behaviours and learn something new. That's how we bring fuel to a new behaviour and take out the friction to the behaviour. But, you know, as leaders in organisations, the way we help people try things out themselves rather than telling them where to go, the way we help people take some of the barbed wire or the, you know, the ditches out of the way of the new behaviour and reduce that friction to doing something new, and the way we kind of help them make it worthwhile, that's, you know, that's really the things we need to be leaning into if you want to scale up new behaviours and mindsets in our organisations. So we all need to go to a beach in sunnier times.
Yes, and I'm no expert on neuroscience, but also that is how the neural pathways form in the brain into creating a new behavior through those little nudges that we help ourselves by observing. So thank you for the analogy. We love an analogy. So I guess you kind of highlighted in your response, Andy, that we are experiencing a massive disruption at the minute, and as society sort of grapples with COVID-19 and social distancing and whatnot. So given what you know about the science of how humans behave and cope with disruption, and disruption is something that we touched upon our previous episode when we spoke with you, what are your thoughts on how we can navigate the current crisis? I suppose the question is to both of you. So, Diane, if you'd like to start on, and Andy to add on, that'd be great.
Sure. And I think there's different parts to, you know, what we're talking about here. One is obviously the emotional concern and the, you know, drain on everyone's personal resources of being concerned about something, about worrying about family, friends, and health in general. And then there's the concern around the economic situation. So it's a highly charged environment. And I think being fueled, if we come back to our fueling and friction and points and analogy, by social media, which is a different input than I think we've ever had in this kind of disruption before. So there's a whole part to how I see it as regaining an element of control. So people, I think, have been feeling as if they've had very little control because of, you know, what they see around them, and, you know, how there's very little any individual can tangibly do when they're looking at, you know, pandemics and global crises of this scale. But finding the things that you can control, finding what's stable and focusing on what's still as it's always been, and some gratitude as well, appreciating what you have and, you know, being thankful for that, obviously linking into mindfulness and the benefits for the brain and, you know, people of that kind of practice. But I think there's then also the things I've been noticing with colleagues, with friends as well, of different personality types respond differently to this situation, and an enforced home working feels dramatically different to making a choice to work from home on a day of a week or at a certain point because you're able to. So flexibility when it's given to you as an order does not feel the same as flexibility you've chosen yourself. And for those who are extroverted more than introverts, I think they're feeling very isolated. They're missing their energy source, which is normally from, you know, the workplace, the social contact, the face-to-face interaction. Whereas those who are perhaps a bit more on the introverted end of the spectrum, some of them, I'm hearing, they're loving it. They're loving the ability to be in a quiet space that they've designed rather than that's, you know, be designed for them, and being able to show up and contribute potentially through, you know, words and texting rather than through voice and sound. So I think people are finding it's quite polarizing. I think the lack of variety is challenging. But I'm also inspired by the creativity and the innovation and how, you know, we're able to have industries come together to solve health crises that have never worked together before, and in a matter of days bring innovation to, you know, respirators and other medical equipment that, you know, hasn't happened in the last 10, 20, probably even more years than that. So humans are incredibly resilient, but I think within organizations, this situation is pushing people to new norms, but also way out of their comfort zone. And I think it's important to acknowledge that. And whilst I'd like it to be a trigger for new ways of working and more flexibility, I think there might well be a knee-jerk reaction when the sort of lockdowns lift, where people, you know, rush straight back to seeing each other physically because they will have missed it so much. So it's really a question of, you know, how do we get through in one piece, supporting each other in this new way of being, And how do we also take what has been valuable from it? And sometimes that is people have tried something they've never tried. You know, my mum, who's turning 84 at the weekend, she has never accepted the iPad we've all been thrusting on her, but suddenly she wants to use it because she can have a face-to-face conversation with me and her grandkids. So it's a trigger for adoption, but it's also a time where there's emotional charge around. So we need to help people in the transition back into a normal that brings the goodness and doesn't have the concern attached to it.
Andy, is there any observations on your end that you would like to add on?
I think the point you made earlier on, and we talked a lot about previously on trust and psychological safety, is super important. We talked about that as the kind of sort of the one ring to rule them all in terms of the environment for enterprise agility. And I think it's very much pertinent now as we start to work remotely and, you know, go through a period where, as Dinah said, a lot of people are, you know, personally living through a lot of disruption and there's a lot of fear. So, you know, how as leaders in organisations we have created or are creating a place of trust and safety and being deliberate about the environment we're trying to create with people, I think is hugely important. And I think in a situation where we're working remotely, we need to work that even harder. You know, we need to try and reduce the distance. We need to try and reduce the fact that communications can become very asynchronous and forced, and find those kind of new habits about how we communicate and listen and create dialogue that reduces some of the fear and increases some of the safety is really important. You know, I think we're going to go through waves of this, as Dinah said. I think we're currently in very much a phase where there's a lot of business continuity work going on. I think we're going to see a bit of rebalancing of what's urgent versus important as we go through the next few months, and probably cycles that beyond. So, you know, creating that ability to move, you know, focus and behaviours around the things that really matter at a point in time is going to matter. That's a very much kind of an attribute of an agile organisation. And I do hope that as we come out of this, I think Dinah's right to point to personal choice, but I do hope we hit a place where we do deliberately choose some of the things we want to persist from this period of time. Mm-hmm. There's been some great examples of people, you know, leaning into making teams more human, people reaching out to, you know, neighbours and their community, becoming more connected with their kids' learning. All those things are, you know, fantastic, you know, things. Now, what bits of that do we want to bring into the new version of normal? And do we want, you know, there's a question for us as leaders in organisations and each as individuals about how do we make sure the new normal that we do eventually get to is better than the normal was in the past. I think for me that's not going to be one size fits all, as Dinah says. That's going to be very much, there's going to be individual choice in there, but that's where, you know, real flexibility and individual individual choices, actually that should be part of the conversation with each employee about what do they want to have, how do they want to have their work pattern, how do we make that part of being a truly agile organization.
Completely. And I think I see a lot of people are almost unconsciously learning how to be agile, sort of without realizing that is what they're doing, just by, you know, learning how to be flexible and how to adjust their everyday routines and the way that they're communicating with people. So it's albeit a very sort of uncomfortable time to be in, it's also very interesting to just observe where human creativity is taking us. So on that note, Andy and Diana, even though I don't want to finish our conversation because it is so interesting, are there any final thoughts that you would like to share with our listeners on the topic?
Go on, Andy. Do you want to go first?
We can move mindsets and behaviours with people, and those things can have a huge impact on how our businesses perform and the future of our businesses. it is hugely possible to do so, and we need to exercise that muscle in leadership an awful lot more.
My final thoughts: behavioral science has changed how society acts, and we've got the ability and the opportunity now to take this to client organizations, so take what's been working in everybody's personal lives and society into the workplace to create that change for good.
This is great. Thank you very much for the positive note that we ended our conversation on. I have made some notes because we mentioned some really interesting things around nudge, around design thinking, around Dana Reilly's research and book. So we'll make sure to reference those at the end of the episode and also on my blog. But a huge, huge thank you for the incredibly interesting conversation, for all the insights, all the food for thought, and last but not least, the really positive end with regards to our current environment. So thank you for bringing the positivity and sharing the lessons learned and insights.
Cheers. Thanks, Dana.
Thanks, Ellie. Thanks, Ellie.
Thank you.
Cheers.
You've been listening to Talking Agility with host Elitza Nacheva. To find more great episodes, visit accenture.com/talkingagility.